Welcome to the Health and Happiness Program, now broadcasting for approximately 8 years here on KGVM 95.9 FM and KGVM.org. The Public Education Committee of the Montana Psychological Association provides support to our station, and our station has given us the opportunity to broadcast information on mental health and other interesting health and happiness issues. This show is broadcast at 7 p.m. Monday evenings and 9 o'clock a.m. on Thursdays. I am Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist, with Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech language pathologist, as your co-host. Dr. Suzanne now introduces today's program and today's notable guest.
We were once in a seminar where a brilliant behavioral scientist described the Horsehead Nebula, an amazing group of stars in a faraway galaxy. He described how many years of education and technology and visionary work were required to reach that far into outer space and find and then even take a picture of the Horsehead Nebula. He then told us that we need to reach equally far into inner space to provide the same resources and effort to reach within the soul, in the spirit, in the heart of humankind. Today, we will be reaching into our inner space with the noted psychologist, author, and newly elected president of the Montana Psychological Association, Dr. Wamadiwi Rose. Welcome, Dr. Rose. We are so honored to have you with us today.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me with you. This is a wonderful opportunity.
We're really proud of your recent election, and could you tell us how you maybe became interested in becoming a psychologist, especially for young people out there who might be considering what they'd like to do?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in off and on in Montana, and my dad was in the service, and my mom was at first she was, you know, just a stay-at-home mom with me and my sister. And after my parents got divorced, my mom decided to go back to school. So she had her bachelor's in psychology, and she thought that she wanted to go and pursue her master's and her doctorate. And so as a little girl, I watched my mom go to school, and she'd have a lot of times her friends over, and they'd be discussing things about psychology. And I think it really struck or piqued my interest in the field when I was about 8 years old. And I remember me and my sister and one of our friends, Jason, we were all kids, and all of our, my mom and then his mother were all in the doctoral program in Logan at Utah State. And during that time, they had a conference. It was for the Society of Indian Psychologists, and it was one of the first ones that they ever had. And during that conference, they had a retreat. And so I remember sleeping upstairs and hearing all these Native American students and professors, and they were talking downstairs about issues facing mental health issues facing our reservation communities and tribal nations. And I heard them talk about suicide and domestic violence and alcohol and drug abuse. And I heard, you know, I growing up on the reservation, I witnessed a lot of those things, and it wasn't a hidden thing from me. You know, it was alive and there in our community for everyone to see. But listening to people, my mom, you know, and other students talk about the things that they could do to address it, it made me really realize that there's hope and that there's a way that we could actually start seeing problems in our community and finding ways to make our communities healthier again. And I think that was the first time for me that it was just a sense of hope although there's bad things going on, if you care and if you work hard enough, then there's ways that you can actually make a difference and start changing things for the better. And so I think from that kind of sparked my interest. And then as I grew up, when I was in high school, I got the opportunity to attend the Inside Indians into Psychology doctoral program. They had a summer institute for high school students who might be interested in psychology. And so I was able to, I applied and I got in for, it was about 2-week program, but we went to the University of North Dakota, and for 2 weeks we learned about psychology. And at the end of that, from professors at the university who are teaching clinicians and stuff, and it was just an amazing experience. You know, it kind of gave me a feel for what college would be like, but also really gave me some good basics of what psychology is. And once I attended that, I really thought, you know what, this might be a good field for me. And then I went to college and I got my bachelor's in psychology, but I was still pretty young and not sure if I wanted to go into graduate school right away. So I spent a lot of time bartending and fighting fires and waitressing, and was just kind of considering what avenue I wanted to go into. Then I got married and I had my first daughter. And at that time I was working as a receptionist at a dental clinic. And I really just thought, you know, I want something a little bit more for me and for my children. And I knew that psychology was always something I was interested in. And I started studying and reached out and did my GREs and was able to get accepted into the University of North Dakota Indian Psychology program. And that's pretty much where it started. It just took off from there. And now, as a practicing clinician, I'm so thankful I made that choice. I love the field of psychology. I love being able to help my people on the Blackfeet Reservation. And it's just that my job is really not a job. It's something that has given me a lot of meaning in my life. And so that's kind of how I got to where I am now.
I love that story. I especially love, for young people out there trying to figure out what they want to do, take your time, look around, and find something that you fervently want to do. It's worthy of that effort, yes.
What I like is the fact that you got a lot of experience in life doing different things before you went back to graduate school or continued your education. And I know so many people that feel like, well, you know, here I am 21 years old or 22, and I couldn't go back to school. Well, yeah, you can.
Yeah. Yeah, I know that when I interviewed for graduate school in front of the committee to see if you could get into the program, I'd had my son the day before that interview.
Oh, my goodness.
So I was in the hospital. I just had a cesarean, so I'm still kind of out of it, a little bit on pain medication. So I asked my mom, I said, okay, mom, I was like, I have this interview with everybody. Can you just sit in on it? And at the end, when everything is done, tell me if I made sense, because I was so nervous and just in general. But then I was also like, I'm on some pretty heavy pain medication, but I want this, I can do this. And so I was talking with the committee and they're saying, you know, great job. And they're like, can we hear, you know, we know that you're expecting your son. And I was like, yeah. And they're like, so, you know, good luck with that. And I was like, well, thank you. I was like, I had him yesterday. That part of the interview, they're just like, oh my goodness, where are you at? And I was like, oh, I'm in the hospital.
That is an incredible story. Yeah.
Yeah. And my mom, I asked her afterwards, I was like, did I make sense? Was it okay? And she's like, oh, you did wonderful. She was like, you did make sense. And she's like, and you could hear the passion of why this is important for you to get into the program. And I'm like, okay,
maybe,
all right. And
I think maybe all that. Those medications.
When I got that acceptance letter, I was so happy. But yeah.
They just relaxed you to be able to talk just the way you wanted to. Oh, my goodness. Well,
and I remember being, you know, I think especially in going to graduate school, I was 30 when I started, and I had, you know, my two little ones, and there was definitely times when I was wondering if I could do it, you know, two little ones at home, my husband was in school too, and, you know, most of my colleagues didn't have children, and so a lot of times they'd be studying, or they'd have that time to study, And I think it would be, you know, I think there's definitely times where I wondered if I could even do it because with so two little ones and trying to find time to study, and I would be up till 3 or 4 in the morning most times, and then getting to school at, you know, 7 to try to get the kids dropped off and then go to classes and stuff. And so I look back on it, and I think when I was doing it, I thought, oh gosh, it would have been maybe so much easier without children. But I think honestly, they gave me the strength to continue, because it was really hard and it was really difficult. And there was times where I didn't think I could do it. But looking at my kids, I said, well, you're in it now, and you're doing it not only for you, but for them. And I think that's something that psychology has always kind of been for me, is I'm not just doing it for me, it's doing it for everybody else out there, to make sure that I can be as helpful as I can in this lifetime.
That's just the ideal way to look at it in my book, but also it points out for everyone out there, graduate school or college is not easy, but it sounds like to me you're saying, boy, is it worth it.
It sure is. I mean, and I think that, you know, I found that while I had to do all the studying and everything else on my own and, you know, put in that work, it was also just the support of everyone around me, my teachers, my colleagues, people who had known my, you know me from a little girl and seen my mom going to all these conferences and stuff. They reached out and offered support. And when it would get really hard, everybody would just say, you can do this, you got this, you know? And so I think that graduate school, it is very difficult. You have to really want it and you have to work hard at it, but it's possible. And you meet so many wonderful people along the way that are there to help you. And, you know, they cannot walk that path for you, but they're there beside you, helping you. And I think that's just a wonderful human experience.
So this says you should select something to do in life that really is meaningful to you, and then just go after it no matter how difficult it might get from time to time. Hmm.
Yeah. And I think it's also that if you're doing something that maybe isn't as satisfying for you, yeah, there you can always go and chase that. If you want something that's different in your life, you're never too old to go and get that. You don't give up on that and just settle if you're truly unhappy, because I think that leaks into every aspect of your life. If you're happy with what you're doing, or at least content, then it really does make a big difference in your mental health and your happiness long term.
This reminds me of a friend we have who got out of the Marines around age 52, 53, and he'd always wanted to be a doctor. And for Pete's sake, he applied to medical school at that age, and they accepted him. And his thinking was, well, I'll be an older doc, but I'm healthy and vigorous, and I'll have another 20 years to practice medicine if all goes well. And by the time we knew him, he was a successful physician with his own practice. And so that's another stirring story for us. Oh, well,
it really is.
We appreciate your work with the Montana Psychological Association. Do you have any specific goals or things that you're targeting for as the brand new president of the Montana Psychological Association?
Well, I think that there's so many. When I first got into Montana Psychological Association, I just had gotten my license. I finished my doctorate. I was so, so happy and stuff, but I still felt new to, I guess in traditional ways, like for Native Americans, I didn't feel like I was an elder. I didn't feel like I had that, I hadn't earned the right yet to be able to be really part other than just a member of MPA. And my mentor and, I mean, just lifelong supporter, Gita Sweeney, had written to me and said that she was sick and that they had asked her who she thought would be a good person to consider for her seat on the board of a diversity delegate, and she had reached out to me, and she said, you were the first person I thought of, and I wanted to see if you'd be interested. And I expressed those concerns to her, just saying that I'm not sure, you know, I don't have that much experience behind me. There's so many other people that have done so much amazing things. I'm not sure if I felt a little bit too green to be able to be considered to that. And she just said, well, I'm telling you as an elder that I'm saying that you're good enough to do it, and that I believe that you would be good for this position, and that you could bring a lot of good things to Montana. And with that, if someone like Gita has that much faith in me, then I realize, you know, I couldn't, I would be a dishonor to her to say that she's wrong.
Absolutely.
So I took that up. And then when I first met all the wonderful people at MPA, again, it was just meeting other Montanan psychologists who have this passion for mental health and wellness and for looking out for our communities. And so it created a sense of professional home for me that that I hadn't had since I'd been out of the INSIDE program at University of North Dakota, and really outside of the Society of Indian Psychologists, just seeing all these amazing people and, you know, these professionals who I would hope to someday be able to say, I've done as much as them, welcome me, and not only just welcome me, but want to hear what I had to say. And so from there, it just, you know, when they asked if I would be consider running for president, I gave it some thought and I said yes. another great advice that I got from the APA president about 4 years ago was, she told me, she said, when you're afraid to do something because you don't think that you're good enough or that you don't think that you've earned it, she said, that's the time that you step forward and you sit in that fear and you take it. You say yes, because if it's being offered to you, it means that somebody sees something great in you, and you have to take that role, even if you're afraid, because that's what leadership is. And you do it in the best way that you can, and you also remain humble, recognizing that you don't know everything and that you still have something to learn. And I think that was also one of those moments where, when I was offered or asked if I would consider running for Montana Psychological Association president, that came to mind. And then everybody's confidence in my ability to do it, that's why I took it. And my hope for Montana Psychological Association was just to really provide that community for all of the psychologists in Montana, to offer a place where we could focus on mental health needs of our communities, of ourselves, and hopefully provide a richer and better place when we leave.
You really didn't have a chance, did you? That was just... they were going to grab you. That's so perfect.
I find that that's kind of the way of life too. You know, you get offered opportunities, and it's in that fear. I think all of us have had it, where wondering if we're good enough, if we're smart enough, you know, to be able to do it. And I do think that I haven't been doing this alone. I have the support of all of you and the other members of Montana Psychological Association. And just like being Native, I learned from those who've gone before me. And at least within this organization, everybody has been more willing to give advice, and good advice without making you feel bad about yourself, or, you know, or just to cut you down. And I think that's something that I found to be really great for the organization I'm part of. And I hope that continues after I'm gone too.
And you know, that's such a great example for each of us, that if we don't take on new challenges, we can't grow into those, we can't learn from those. And so it really behooves us to want to jump in there when the call comes.
Yeah.
Two things I really like about you, among many, is that I see you as humble and very genuine. That to be genuine is something that's lacking in so many interactions, is that it's a transactional thing. It's not like really that important to the other, but you make all of us feel like, hey, what you see is what you get, and that's great.
I do try. I remember once in graduate school, they told me, one of my advisors had said, you know, you see a problem and you go at it head on. No waiting for it. You just tackle it. And they're like, sometimes it can kind of be like a bull in the china shop. and they're like, but you walk into that china shop seeing that everything is, maybe it's not the way that it's supposed to be, that it's only for a few people that are welcome in there. And they're like, and so you'd rather destroy it and yeah. make it a place for everyone than just let it stand as a, you know, something that's just going to keep going on and on. Yeah, that's kind of how I see things. You know, I try to be kind. I try to be open-minded, and I try to help others. But I also, I guess, I have a very low tolerance for others who aren't doing the right thing by. If they're only doing it for themselves, then that's where I have a really bad problem with it. But I guess I'm also okay with who I am.
Yes, and. You know, taking on this responsibility for the state of Montana, the outlook is kind of serious in Montana. A survey not long ago, 1 out of 5 Montanans feels a need for mental health care. And we've got one of the highest suicide rates in the nation. And our young people have the highest suicide rate. So when you say, I'm going to head up this organization, it's like, thank you for accepting that heavy load. And boy, we all want to be able to help you with this.
Yeah. Well, and I think Montana and the people who work here recognize the need for good providers. And it's just, we're so spread thin, you know, and
yes.
I think that we also, you know, place the urban areas, you know, they have the funding and the money to be able to tackle multiple problems, to be able to get lobbyists into their state governments, to be able to really advocate for mental health needs. And in Montana, we don't have that kind of funding. And there really isn't that many of us. And so it really takes, I think, an organization like ours, and hopefully to get people who are passionate and want to be involved. I just think that that's really important for us, you know, and if there's not more that want to take that lead or at least offer their help, their time, then it really is left up to a small few. You know, who are trying to do that, but it gets hard to try to fight for what Montanans need if we don't have a lot of people willing to spend their time to do it.
Not only that, we just don't have enough. If everybody pitched in and helped, we're still having a critical shortage across the state of Montana of counselors and psychologists. So I was wondering if you could, for those out there who might consider going into this field, kind of talk about the educational requirements and the pathways, and maybe tell young people out there a little bit about how to become a psychologist.
Well, I think that anyone, if you have that drive and you work hard, can get into this profession. I do think that it does take an individual who's willing to maybe step out of their comfort zones and have empathy. And it doesn't mean that you agree with everybody that you see or the patients that you treat, but you have to really want and have that in your mindset of, I am here to help you live the best life that you could possibly live. You have to put in the work to get there, but I'm willing to be that person to help you. And I think that when you have that need to help people and that compassion to listen to other people's stories and give them a safe place to express themselves, then psychology is a place for you. And, you know, you go through high school, you know, try to do as well as you can on your grades. You will have to go to college, And I think that if you're going to get into psychology, it is okay too to be able to take a little bit of time, you know, be able to live life just a little bit, just to, so that that way when you go into this, you know that this is what you really wanted to do. And you go through your, do your undergrad, and you, you know, which should hopefully be very fun and exciting. And you take your psychology classes, which are really great when you're in grad. It really, at least for me, got me excited about psychology. But I also was, you know, being in undergrad, I also gave my time to explore things that I also thought were interesting. I did a lot of history classes because I love history. I think if I wasn't a psychology, I would have loved to have been a historian. You know, and then I just explore a little bit. And then once you're done with your undergrad, if you decide that you want to move further in your education, then I would, you know, look at going for your doctorate. Master's programs right now, I know that there's been some major changes where different programs are looking at offering a master's degree for psychology, where once you get that master's degree, you're able to practice. I know up until recently, that wasn't really an option for psychologists to be able to provide clinical services with your master's. I'm correct on that, right?
Yes. In fact, that is I think it's already passed the APA's Council of Representatives, and it's being be implemented in the near future.
So that might be an option. But I would really suggest that if you're wanting to have a career in psychology where you have so many opportunities and so many different avenues that you can take as a psychologist, then getting your doctorate is the way to go.
I totally agree.
Because psychologists, we have so many different things. You could just focus on testing. You could focus on neuropsychology. You could focus on organizational psychology. You could be a general psychologist where you're kind of dabble in a little bit of everything, and then, you know, a good clinical psychologist where you're working with people on a daily basis. You can do groups, you can do marriage counseling, you can see kids, you can see adults. I mean, again, it's kind of like a physician where it's a lot of times people specialize. So if you want to see children, a lot of times you focus most of your training and your internship experiences on working with children. Same thing for a neuropsychologist, you get all of your basics in graduate school, but then you get to maybe choose a little bit more of a focal point. And so I think that if you want to do that, there's a lot of different avenues to take. A lot of programs have good financial aid, but it is expensive and it does take some time, but at least from my point of view, it's completely worth it.
We were at dinner last night, Dr. Rose, with a lady who spent her life as a psychologist and has retired, but she just said so eloquently, I have loved helping people, sitting with them, talking to them and counseling them and helping them work through these difficulties in life. And she was so heartfelt about the joy of having been able to do that.
And I think it's really an interesting profession that we're in too, because sometimes you don't know, sometimes you know if you help somebody because they'll come back and they'll say, you really helped me, or, you know, this is going so much better. But sometimes they've gotten what they've needed, their life is going in a better trajectory, and they just stop showing up. So sometimes you don't quite know the impact that you have on someone. But it's the knowledge that you're going in there with a good heart and good intentions. And I think that it's not something like where you're a physician and you can see that they're doing better because their stats have gone down, right? And you know, their cholesterol is lower, their blood pressure is lower, they're absolutely physically healthier. You don't necessarily get that as a psychologist. But sometimes you get to see those gems where you see them out in the community and you can see that they're living their life, right? You can see that they're happier, you know, and that's kind of what I just enjoy that And even when somebody whose lives might be really, really difficult, at least they had the opportunity to talk to somebody. At least what I try to do is at least be present with them and show them that I do care, that they are valuable in a whole big world of millions and millions and millions of people. And for that time when I'm talking with them, they matter. And so I do, I just love it. So your colleague is right. It does, it gives me a great feeling at the end of my day, at the end of the weekend, just to be able to say, okay, I saw a lot of people who are struggling, and right, I can clear my conscience by saying that I feel like I was helpful.
Also, we would point out that Orlis talks about the difficulties for counselors because you're taking on other people's problems, and so it can take a toll on your spirits as well.
Yes,
I think Arliss is right. Yeah, Arliss, what have you kind of found?
Well, over the years, I think I have several lifetimes, but through psychology, what I have, I think I took it on as an extra burden for years, and that I think that would cause the psychologist problems in him or herself, but for some reason, it either evolved or maybe I worked on it some. I have compartmentalized some of the horrendous things I've heard and seen trying to help people. It's there, but I'll go to it if I need to or want to, as far as the interactions or the issues that people were wrestling with. But it's gotten to a point where that's not an issue on an everyday basis. And so psychologists, there was a movement for a while in the history of psychology talking about self-care of professional psychologists is part of that. So how do you deal with your stress, Dr. Rose? How do you deal with what you hear and see?
I think early on I realized that for me, working with children was going to be too difficult. I had the experience of working with children in different things, and to me it just broke my heart too much, especially if there was abuse or sexual abuse or, other traumas. To me it hurt me too much as a person. To be able to sit in that space with a child, I found myself getting angry, not at the child, but just the circumstances, and feeling a lot more helpless than helpful. And so I realized early on that was just not a place where I would be able to shine. I would burn out too quick. I would be taking that home every single night. And so for me, working with adults, I can hear the trauma. I can hear, as a therapist, you hear a lot of very difficult things. And for me, I'm able to say, I'm working with, you lived through that as an adult, I can help you, right? You've already gone through it. Now I can help you live with the memories. I can help you live with what you're dealing with in a way that now as an adult, you're going to be able to comprehend and work through a lot easier. My mom, she works with children. That is what she does, and she's very good at it, and she loves it. I asked her, how do you not take that home? And she said, I think for her, she does take it home a lot more than I do with my patients. I think that for self-care, I think sometimes I probably suck at it, to be honest. I think after graduate school, my favorite thing to do before graduate school is reading Stephen King books. I love Stephen King. And I found that after the first year, after I got done with my ECCC and everything else, I sat down to read for pleasure and I couldn't do it. It was a struggle for me to get through 10 pages because my mind was jumping from here to there to, what about this person, maybe I should help with this, maybe I should read more up on this. And so recognizing if I make my life all about, getting more CEUs, reading more psychology books, reading more of this, I'm never taking myself out of work mode. And I started recognizing that I was just tired all the time. and not being able to, you know, do things that my kids would like to do. Like, I'd go for a walk, but I wasn't really present on the walk. I was thinking of other things or trying to figure out the next day's schedule. And I think that that was kind of more of a wake-up call for me, just to recognize I'm not present with the people who matter to me the most, who, you know, at the end of the day, I love what I do, but I love the people in my life a lot more. And so recognizing that I had to find a balance with that was kind of hard. I think I do that through crafting. I'll do it with, you know, sitting down with my daughter and doing an art project with her, you know, listening to my son play his guitar, or, you know, just going for a nice fishing trip with him, playing with my dogs. I think it's just taking those little bit of moments of saying, if I wasn't working, what would bring me the most joy? And taking that time at least a couple times a week to just make sure that I'm doing something for me that helps me feel less tired.
Oh, that's such a good model for the children also, that no matter how busy a professional you are, you still, your family, your fireside, all of that is paramount. Yeah, first thing.
One quick story. Yes. You reminded me of good and bad things in my distant past. My really first experience of psychotherapy was at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. As a master's level psychologist, we were called that because in the military they can use that term lawfully, but they needed people to deal with the troops, Marines coming and going to Vietnam. And honestly, I had no experience, zilch, in psychotherapy. I had it in testing from the master's program, but they just took me because they needed someone to fill the position. Gave me said I was a first lieutenant before, well, actually lieutenant in the Navy, 03. And I went into the Naval Hospital, and a Harvard-trained psychiatrist named Dr. McGrail said, "Here's your office, I'm down the hallway if you need me." And I thought I was thrown into Dante's Inferno, because here are these people with all these serious problems. And it was just really on-the-job training, which APA, MPA, nobody would recommend any program that's the way to learn. So with about four psychiatrists around, two neurologists, as many of them extremely, they took me in and if you will, through that horrendous experience for me at the time, which turned into something beautiful later in that I learned to deal with it. When you talk about stress, Suzanne knows when I would come home there across the bay, it's Camp Lejeune, beautiful area, except for the toxic water we found out later they were feeding us. So that for those listening, yes, we could have some very difficult times, but hey, you have to deal with it. You dealt with it. I have so far. And I wanted to point out that you're from a group that is unique and very honorable in its heritage, the Native American population. And I realize there is some research that shows that in Montana, and my guess is other states, has some unique issues. Can you talk to that?
Sure. I mean, I know that, you know, at least in Montana, and I also lived down in Arizona on the Navajo Reservation when I was young. I think, but specifically for Native populations, you know, there's a history of, you know, of historical trauma, which I think is being studied more now than it ever was, even when I was younger. Even when I went to get my bachelor's, it was just starting to be kind of talked about. You know, and so I know that for me, you know, my grandparents all had gone to boarding school. And so I grew up hearing about some of those stories, and knowing how how scary it was. My great grandpa, he had a skateboarding school when he was about 8, made his way through and was able to become a farmer down in Poplar, Montana. But he always told us growing up that education is the way out for us. Education is a way to help our people. And so looking at that and then looking at our communities, and you know, it was, it's hard on the reservation, it was definitely, that's how the government had set it up. Reservations were never supposed to be easy. And we survived, but through that survival, we also had a lot of difficulties that we've had to address currently too. And so that, you know, a lot of reservations struggle with poverty. You know, it can be very hard to find the resources that you need when there's not a lot of money there to be had. You know, there wasn't a lot of choices for, at least even now, on most reservations, you have to rely on IHS, the Indian Health Service, for those services. And, you know, and then also just, you know, there is a problem with addictions for a lot of individuals on the reservation. And there's also, you know, high rates of suicide, high rates of domestic violence, and grief. You know, I think that out of all the things that I've seen in a lot of different communities, I think grief is the one that hits, at least my community, the hardest. Is sometimes, that's where I think it's the most difficult for me as a clinician, is sometimes I talk to my patients and afterwards I do cry afterwards sometimes, because there's nothing else you can do, because I just can't understand sometimes how resilient my people can be faced with just one hardship after another, and the ability for them to keep going on. And sometimes it's a struggle, you know, sometimes they've fallen into addiction. But for me, anyone who comes through that door is looking for help. Anybody coming through there is looking for hope and an opportunity to start picking their lives back up. And so I think that that's a lot of what I see. I think that there's not a lot of funding for mental health issues on reservations. I think that a lot of times people have the misconception that as natives, we get everything for free. And that what we get is really top of the line. And I would welcome anyone, if you want to get your services through IHS, and I don't mean to bash IHS, we have a lot of good providers there, but just not a lot of funding. And so it makes it really difficult. And so I think that, at least through Montana, I'm very proud of all the tribes of Montana for the work that they try to put in for mental health issues, with a lot of time, not a lot of funds. And it's also really hard to get providers who want to live on the reservation or work with people on the reservation, especially if they're not from there or aware of the cultural aspect of working on Native reservations. So.
And, you know, I think it's notable in this conversation that in October of 2021, just recently, the American Psychological Association passed resolutions calling for an apology and issuing an apology for psychology's role in perpetrating racism toward the Native American population. They created a noteworthy apology for not paying more attention and doing their job and understanding.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I know that APA worked pretty closely with the Society of Indian Psychologists to, when they're contemplating issuing that apology and how it would be done. And I think that it was a nice gesture. It meant a lot. I think, though, that any kind of apology has to be followed through with action.
Amen. Yes.
So I think that if it's nice to issue an apology, but I think it would be just as important to see APA actually addressing some of these, the issues on the reservations, and being able to work with the tribes to say, how can we help you now?
Yes, acknowledgement is one thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's easy to say, we did this in the past and we're sorry. Mm-hmm. But I think it would mean a lot more if they said, and we're willing to address some of the issues that you're facing now. How can we best help you?
And that brings up a question. I was hoping you could tell us a little bit more about the Society of Indian Psychologists, or SIP, that group, and maybe tell us a little bit about that.
SIP was founded in order to represent and help address Native American mental health issues. So when it started off, I think, I hate to do it, but I think there was only about like 20 or so Native psychologists in the United States at that time. Mm. And so recognizing that our communities have the need for culturally competent providers to be able to help us address our issues. And it also was very important that the psychologists going in there not only were culturally competent, but it's very helpful if they are actually Native too, because there's the cultural concepts that a lot of times no one's going to discuss with somebody who's outside of that community. And it also means that if you're Native and you're going into another community, you might not be part of them, like going down and living on the Navajo reservation. I'm not Navajo, but it did make a difference that I was Native. Mm-hmm. It's that shared experience that so many tribes have had with dealing with the United States, but then also it's kind of, yeah, we went through something similar, a little bit different, but all of us know what it was like to have our culture stripped away. All of us have had, you know, those boarding school eras, and then also just, you know, long walks for our people. You know, for the Blackfeet, they had starvation winter. For the Navajo, they had the, you know, in the Cherokee, they had the long walks. You know, even the Flathead and Salish Kootenai had their removals. And so I think that there is that shared experience. So SIP was really created to be able to for Native psychologists, because I've never met a Native psychologist who doesn't want to help their people. And so it really was created as a way to focus on Native American mental health at a time when a lot of people, it just feels like a lot of times Natives are forgotten. Maybe not so much in Montana, because we're the, out of all the minorities in Montana, we're the largest one. But I think it still feels like we're kind of forgotten. And so SIP was really created to address those. And since then, it's grown into a very large organization. They offer, it's structured on more traditional values. So they have at the top, they have the Circle of Elders. And so it's all the past presidents of SIP who all sit on as the Circle of Elders. And then you have the trio, which is the past president, the incoming president, and the current president. And they discuss more current issues. And then we have our membership. And within that membership, there's a huge support of students, whether they're undergraduates to graduates to even high school students. If you're interested in psychology and you want to learn more about it, you have as many mentors as you can throw a rock at, because they are very involved in helping uplift students and helping them on their path to become great therapists, healers, researchers, whatever it is that you want to do within psychology, that's what they're there for.
And I know that you're doing everything one would hope for. You've written research articles, you've written about the cultural adaptation for therapy with American Indians and Alaska Natives. Tell us a little bit about your work, Dr. Rose.
Well, right now I'm currently working for the Blackfeet Behavioral Health, and I was fortunate enough to do telehealth with them, because I live in Great Falls, so driving back and forth to Browning is a little bit difficult. And really, my work right now has just been focusing on clinical therapy. I think that for a long time, IHS, they had two psychologists, and they were just overwhelmed. There's such a huge need in our community, and they just weren't able to meet that need. And so the tribe was able to create some of their own programs. And my mother, she sees, or Dr. Rebecca Crawford Foster, she sees children, and then I see all the, as many adults as I can. So that's really been my focus right now, is just trying to address the need. And there's so much need, as best as I can within my people. And I know that it was really hard to make that decision to come back and work on my tribe, with my tribe. It was always a dream, but I also knew that it would be hard, because I think within that, you know, there's the ethical standard of, you know, you're not supposed to have, you know, dual relationships or anything else. Well, that's really hard if you're a Native American going back to work in your community, because when they say everyone's related, that really is true.
Yeah.
You know, but it's also, that's where I feel my best work has been done, is being able to and just be there, help my people. And so many, I have the look of relief when I'll have a patient talking about, you know, oh, I live over, well, I guess you wouldn't know where it's at. It's called Easter Egg Homes, or, you know, I live over in low rent and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I know where that's at. Just to see him go, you do? And I'm like, yeah, I grew up there. I went to high school there. You know, I lived in East Glacier. That's where my, and they're just like, oh my goodness. And just to see the relief of, okay, I don't have to worry so much that they're not going to understand how difficult it is here. I don't have to tell them that, you know, sometimes it's not possible for me to just go down and get, you know, a salad if I'm struggling with my weight from the local grocery store, because it's $8 for a bag of salad. You know, it's nice to have that connection and be able to understand that. And it's also really important for me when they're talking about traditional things to know what they're talking about and not have to have questions. And you know, I had one individual say, you know, it's just nice not to feel judged or to feel scared to talk about some of the things that I experience in traditional ceremonies, because I'm afraid that the person who's talking to me won't understand and think I'm crazy.
You know, I was reading that so many of the historic traditional values of the Native American community serve as protective factors against this huge onslaught of difficulty. And it just made me almost wish I were Native American, reading about the cultural values that included strong family bonds, community connectedness, respect for elders, meaningful traditions, and spiritual practices. And reading about those, I'm sure that has been preservative for so many who otherwise might lose all hope.
It really is. And I think that, you know, it's what was interesting to me when I was applying for internships. I applied to a lot of different VAs and stuff. And I remember going to the one in Boise. They have a great program down there. And even the one here in Montana, they have sweats. And they have sweats for veterans. And it was interesting hearing them talk about why they implemented the sweats for the veterans. And it was directly because of historically how Native tribes treated their veterans and welcoming them back, helping them process, helping them get their feet back onto the underneath them and feeling balanced. And so it was really neat for me to be able to see that they're implementing some of our traditional ways in a really thoughtful and impactful way. And it just blows my mind that, you know, up until the 70s, you know, that was considered illegal, you know. And so it's nice to be able to know that we're able to practice our traditions without having to be afraid of being arrested or having our children taken from us. And so I think that that's just something that I think it's hopeful that they're able to start looking at these and implementing them in. I know that there's a lot of research that Native American researchers are doing to see the impact that these traditions have on mental health within the communities. And so I'm excited to see kind of what they find and where that information and data will take us.
Wonderful talk that you're joining us with, and we have just about 3 minutes left. Do you have any words for people who are not Native American about what we could do as a group to support and help?
Well, I just think as human beings, you know, especially with everything going on in the world right now, you know, I think that can feel really overwhelming and scary at times. You know, I've had the privilege to work with people who are Republicans and people who are Democrats, and I think for me, I just see a lot of fear. And the way that we can help everyone and each other is just be kind, just be there and try to be understanding and to look at it as, I just want to help my neighbor. I think that that's really, if we're looking at happiness and longevity and just bringing good to the world, is just being able to be kind with one another, you know, being able to recognize if somebody's struggling and maybe they've hurt you, to be able to look at it and say, okay, you know, I can, you know, help perpetuate this problem, or I can help them find the resources that they need for help, you know, mm-hmm. and that can be, you know, mm-hmm. directing them to see a psychologist, a therapist, directing them, you know, maybe it is making that hard decision when you see something that you think is wrong and hurtful to others, to make that call to CPS, to make that call to law enforcement. Yes. But it is really coming from that place of, I'm doing this because I care, and I'm doing this because I don't want to see people hurt. I want to see them thrive, and try to figure out a way that you can do that. Try to figure out a way that you can help and not hurt. And I think that would just be the best thing.
Spoken well by our president of the Montana Psychological Association.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I'd like to say that I love your presentation today and the genuineness of it, the honesty, and coming from a very unique point of view, one that I think very few people in the community understand because of the way historically Native Americans have been dealt with. And it's seemingly, and I like your idea about kindness, is that many of us think, if it doesn't happen to me, then I don't think about it. But we need to have empathy to see around us and what's happened to people and what can be done about it in the present. I know Gallatin Valley listeners to this program are going to really appreciate what you've had to say, and we got to have you back again. This is fascinating, and we just begin to scratch the surface. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for all the wonderful work that the two of you do and the beautiful things that you bring to our community and our state. And I'm just so very thankful to get the opportunity to know both of you, because you are both been truly amazing. And you know, there's been times, even as the president, where I'm like, oh gosh, I feel a little bit maybe disheartened or a little bit like, okay, I think, you know, I'm not sure how much of a difference I'll make, but talking with the two of you, it gets my fire going, and it really just makes me realize, yep, you can keep going, you can keep doing this, and there's not only, it's not all on me, it's you all just help out so much, the two of you in particular, and wanting to do more. And so thank you for all that you do and for all the effort that you put in to making this world a better place. And that's just, it's truly a wonderful thing to have people like you.
Thank you, Dr. Rose. And we thank the Gallatin Valley listeners to 95.9 KGVM.org. And we'll see you next time. Thank you.